Okay, we're going to start again. And I think this, during the second part, first of all, I would like, again, to ask anybody who has stories to tell or questions to ask to speak up. And we will, this time, Kevin has asked, and I should have thought of this, to be sure to identify you when you are taking the mic back there. But we would really like for you to participate again. During the second half, a couple of things I would like to get people to talk about. One is what, if anything, is distinctive. I've always, in my own folklore training, tells me that you don't talk about things being unique because that means one of a kind, but that, in fact, that there are some really special features about perhaps either the fiddling or the song-making tradition here in the North Country. And also another thing I would like people to talk about during this second part is collecting and the whole history of collecting and some of the issues involved with collecting. And third and finally, as far as I personally am concerned, I would like to also see some talk about passing the music on to the next generation, the role of music in the schools. I hope Lynn can talk about that. As well as several of the performers here who have actually do a lot of work with schools and with school kids. So those are three particular things. Yes, Jill?
Can I just add one other thing?
Yes.
I so enjoyed the Snooks Martin story. If anybody has those kinds of fun out-in-the-field stories that they want to share along the way while you're answering Derek's other questions, I'd love to hear some more of those.
Okay, very good. But Don Woodcock needs to leave us in a few minutes because he has another event to go to. So I would like to actually, because of that, I'd like to get Don to talk a little bit more about his own family and particularly about the style. I don't know whether you even think about that in terms of a style, but the particular way that you play or the particular way that you learned and heard other people play here in the North Country. I know you've traveled a good bit and heard people play from other places. Do you have any comment about anything in terms of the style of music played in fiddling, Don?
You mean here in the North Country?
Yeah, here in the North Country, and particularly maybe as how you've seen it played or heard it played in other places. How would you describe?
Oh, I don't know. It's a mixture, I guess, here in the North Country of styles and things. Mm-hmm. Well, what I grew up with was the old-time style of the fiddling and square dancing and... when I used to go with my father, when he played for dances, they'd do round and square dancing. And the round dances that he used to play were probably big band songs of the 30s and 40s were the round dances, as opposed to country western. I never was around much of that until later years when I started going out and playing bands. There was more of the country western things that I'm not a big country western fan. I don't really care about it, but I played because I enjoyed playing, and so I had to play it. So that was the. I guess I liked the things that my dad used to play.
Which actually brings a question I've always wanted to ask you anyway, so I'm going to ask it in public.
All right.
Why is it so important to you, Don? I know that you, in fact, make a real point of preserving your father's songs, preserving songs from that generation, and all. You often talk about neighbors in your neighborhood around Kendrew.
Yes.
Why is it so important to you, even to the extent that you made an entire recording of the old music? Why is it so important to you to play it
I don't want it to be lost. None of us are going to be here forever, and a lot of the songs that I do, nobody else plays. I learned from my dad, and when I'm gone, I don't want it to be gone. I want it to be on a recording where other people can listen and enjoy them the same as I have, and that's the reason I do that. Mm-hmm. I've done it, and I want to do more, mm-hmm. hopefully.
Do you consciously teach other people, or...?
I occasionally, yes. I work for, of course, I farmed up until about 8 years ago. I worked on the family farm and continued on with that. And when I had enough of that, I sold the cattle, and then I started working for BOCES, St. Lawrence Louis BOCES, as a teaching assistant. And I do some I work with special needs children, and in my travels, I've also been asked to go in classrooms, and so I do work with kids, mm-hmm. Fourth graders. And
do you ever take your fiddle to school?
Oh yes, mm-hmm. Yeah, many times.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Great. Jim.
I thought I was telling Dave a little story. One of the old fiddlers, he was 80 when I was talking to him, Lou Minkley, outside of Albion, New York, in Orleans County. Dad had been a fiddler. I first met him. We were playing a tune I'd learned out of a manuscript dated 1870 nearby, and we were playing it, and he came up and said, "Where'd you learn that tune?" I said, "My dad used to play that tune, the one we just had, this written, untitled tune." So I started visiting him, spent many, many hours visiting him in his kitchen with his son playing. We could not get him to play his dad's tunes for love or money. He had to really twist his arm. He'd fallen in love with Mark O'Connor, music styles. Nashville. He was going to Florida in the winter and sitting in flea markets with guys from Tennessee and wanted to play Wagner and was trying his darndest to sound like Mark O'Connor. Yeah. And that's a kind of fiddling that takes on a wide, whatever, influential life. It's sexier. It's fancier. And equally, some of the Canadian, the Townsend duo, boy, that's great music. But so many of the old square dance numbers, the old style, and this is what really forms so much of New York State local fiddling. The singing calls, like first two ladies crossover, da-dum, da-dum, dum-dum, they tend to be simple tunes. They get more eighth notes than they got 16th notes, and they fit a dance. And this goes way back.
Yeah.
It's a little like trying to get Vic to play the older tunes from the family as opposed to the stuff that was winning contests. Nobody ever won a contest playing an old-time New York State square dance tune.
Just in my own defense, that putting that Vic album together, since I'm the guy who did it, was more of a project than that. It wasn't a matter of just getting Vic to play what he wanted. It was a matter afterwards of selecting from what he did play what was as good a representation as we could get. Because he did some of those old family tunes, but you're right. That's not where his head was.
Right. He really his love.
And the other thing, talking about kinds of tunes and styles that aggravated me no end was that the record company owner, who is a dear friend of us, did not want Vic playing a waltz on that album, which is nuts. He always played waltzes, but she didn't like his long notes. No vibrato.
They weren't quite as smooth as Graham Townsend.
And I lost that one.
Your dad played a lot of those old tunes for square dancing.
Oh, yeah. Done.
The old style. And they're not so complicated.
Can you make any kind of a general overall statement to the effect that New York State fiddle tunes tend to be less ornamented than in the playing style? Than perhaps Southern tunes?
I think in general, the dance tunes. There was always. We got diaries and newspapers talking about guys doing show fiddling, people performing fiddle tunes, contests going back as far as 1900. But the plain old local dance fiddler, I think they were less ornamented.
Definitely.
Yeah. Dave, were you going to comment on that?
Well, yeah, I agree. And from everybody I've talked to and heard comment on it, that would be true. Hermina, I remember when I first met Hermina, I asked her what the difference would be between the way her family fiddled. She grew up in a musical family where everybody played something and they all played to dances and things. What would be the difference between the way they fiddled and a French-Canadian fiddler? And your answer was something to the, let's hear from you about that. How would your family's fiddling differ from a French-Canadian fiddler?
It was mixed with other influences. What Uncle Abe brought from the South when he was in the Civil War kind of became enmeshed with the others. And though they were never distinct to me and my learning, I listened to Randy Kerr play some of the French-Canadian that he knows, and it's different. There are little variations in the tunes. I can play a second with the guitar because the changes are more or less the same, but like with what Don was playing last night, I recognized every one of those tunes, but there were some little fancy things he does that makes him just so special. I never had so much fun playing as I did last time.
I never had so much fun as I did having you play guitar. Telling Don about it.
He was raving about it. Well, that's the wrong answer, actually, Jermina. That's not the answer you gave me the first time. I'm kidding. No, but you said something to the effect that in your family they played the tunes very straight, and there was not a lot of ornamentation.
That's what I mean by comparing his music.
Right.
Yes.
And none of the little trills and none of the little connecting phrases to take the end of the B part back to the A part, whereas the French Canadian fiddler might do a lot more of the ornamentation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Don, I know that at least from your biography that there's a French-Canadian connection there. Are you conscious, Don Perkins, of playing things in a French-Canadian style?
Catch it quick.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's Don Perkins.
That's me, Don Perkins. Well, when I first learned how to play, starting, my mother hummed the tunes and played the piano. And that's how I learned how to play. And I always had to draw the bow right there. If I didn't use the full bow, I wasn't going to get it where I didn't need it. But as I got into it more and listened to it, then, I do these little trills with the finger and then some fancy stuff with the bow. But I do keep it straight.
Remember, that's what Pop wanted it.
Well, I played my first square dance when I was 10 years old at Old McDonald's Farm in Lake Placid. And everything had to be straight. I did not fancy stuff whatsoever. It's play that thing, draw that bow, and play it the way I want to hear it. And that's the way I play. And I, to this day, do the same thing. Yes, I do some trills, but not in all of the songs, because I feel that if you take all these trills and put them in every song you got, you ruin the song. Because it takes away from the way it first come out. And in fact, a couple of years ago, I can't remember the name of the song right now, but I had done this song for a good 30 years, and I was doing it wrong. And I said, boy, I can't remember what the song was, but I said, hell, crazy, I just hear a song quick, play it, and that's it. I wouldn't listen to it again, and I just play it that way. And then I get back to listening to it, and here, come, you're not doing the whole song, you're not doing it right. You got to learn it all over again. So I've come to the realization, if you're going to sit down and learn a song, do it right the first time. Don't do it wrong, because it's 10 times harder the next time around.
And Phyllis, you were going to say?
It's like, sometimes I think that what is right, what is wrong, I think it's all an individual's, the way that they, you can take a song and it can be, I can play a song a certain way and then somebody else is going to hear something different. It's going to be, they're going to kind of, it's interpretation, exactly.
Everybody's different.
Everybody's different, and that's what makes the world go around. So I don't know if there's anything right or wrong in how you play a tune. It's your interpretation of it, and that's what these places are, because you want to learn. You want to learn different things. And although I think in looking back on my mother and father, my mother was so musical. My father was musical, but they did so much, they didn't have, great jobs. They were farmers, and thank God for farmers. They just taught us what they knew, and that's how we learned. I sat on a piano bench when I was 9 years old, and I guess I was about ready. My mom says, well, I guess you can play this square dance. You're ready. Okay. And they just take you by the hand, and this is what you're going to do, and that's the type of people. They had their own ways of of how they wanted things to sound. Well,
the right way or wrong way, my father's way.
You know, they had a kind of a strict hand, but that's okay too. That's the way they were. That's why we love them. And they've taught us so much. But I think it's totally interpretation. I don't think there's really a right way or a wrong way in any kind of music. I really don't.
This
personal opinion.
This brings up a burning question I've always had, and I think it is related, and I'd love to ask it while Don's here, if it's okay with you, Varick.
Sure.
And this is for everyone. Why do you suppose, let's take Southern fiddling for a second, and we think that they're one of the things that differentiates Southern fiddling from Northern fiddling is it's a bit bluesier, and often that's attributed to the African American influence, right? Why in the North Country, why don't we hear more French Canadian influence in Adirondack fiddlers? In other words, you hear fiddlers from this area all the time talk about there was a Frenchman in camp, he was a great fiddler, we learned these songs from him. So I used to walk 3 or 4 miles to go hear this one French Canadian guy up near the border. So we have French Canadian fiddlers interfacing with Adirondack fiddlers, but the things that we think of as classically French Canadian about fiddling, the foot percussion that often goes with it, the tunes in F and B flat, the crooked tunes, the tunes that don't go to an even 8/16 or 8 bars. Why don't we hear more of that creeping into Northern New York fiddling?
Because we're English. On that, I gotta go.
I wish I could say I love it, but I gotta go to that wedding or I'll get it. We'll see you tonight.
Right. We'll see tonight, Don.
Bill Smith commented once on the division in older lumber camps that the French guys are over here and the English-speaking guys are over here. B-flat and F are hard for a lot of people to accompany. I've been to fiddle events there was a good one. Allegheny had a fiddle show years ago in New York down Cattaraugus County, and there was a fiddle there I knew had a lovely B-flat waltz. And they had a piano on stage that was tuned a whole step flat.
Yeah.
And this man's wife was used to playing. Well, when it got to the stage, you can't tune the fiddle down a whole step. So he stuck with the stage band, electric bass guitar and a rhythm guitar, who can't play in B-flat. So he plays Soldier's Joy and Red Wing and tunes he knows they know. This is a problem in group picnic kinds of settings. You wind up playing what the stage backup group can know. But B-flat's a hard key for a lot of people to pick up on.
I have a wonderful device here. It's called a capo. Yeah. Put it on the 3rd fret, you finger a G chord, and it comes out B-flat. I use this constantly.
As is Lynn, yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
I think that's the reason, really. That's got a lot to do with it.
Well, who's it? Catherine Levere, said in Whitehall there were two Catholic churches. There was the Irish Catholic Church and there was the French Catholic Church, and you didn't cross over, and you didn't. So that might be another reason why the French Canadian style didn't necessarily get into the Adirondack style.
I think that's
style.
True.
Bit of prejudice from one side to the other.
Ah. Even though the fiddlers, the non-French Canadian fiddlers, talk with such admiration about the French Canadian fiddlers, hear that almost across the board.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he was a wonderful, French fiddler, and even to the point where they swap tunes. But stylistically, you don't hear much of that French Canadian, the idiosyncrasies of French Canadian fiddling, working their way into the fiddling here.
I think there's a danger. I don't know if Jim would agree, and I float this as a balloon I'm not sure of. In recent years, there has been a massive reclamation of French-Canadian and Franco-American identity. Mm-hmm. In a lot of the older generation, I'm talking about people my age, I'm 70 or younger, you didn't say you were French. It was a way to be discriminated against.
Mm-hmm.
the Kentucky Colonels from Maine, one of the seminal bluegrass bands. Clarence White, one of the great flat-picking guitarists, killed by a car late one night loading after a gig. Name was LeBlanc. Mm-hmm. But they were white when they were playing Kentucky Colonels. Mm-hmm. And I remember a concert we did over in Plattsburgh one time years ago, and there was a woman singing French-Canadian songs. This is a concert Vaughn and I had put on. I was walking around the back of it. This old fellow sitting in a lawn chair, 500 people, entranced. This old guy looks up at me and he says, "You think anybody enjoys this stuff?" And I said, 500 people, do you enjoy it? Oh, yeah, I enjoy it, but I'm French. This is the sort of self-hate that you get into when you're discriminated against. Also, with that reclamation, just a quick, Dave, there's been a lot of reclamation of some of the particular stylistic quirks of French stuff, crooked tunes, clogging. Everybody's got to be able to play with their feet now.
Right.
It wasn't always so. I can remember older generation players that never clogged and probably couldn't.
French-Canadian or Franco-American?
Franco-Americans, yeah. American. So I think there was some crossover. It depends to what extent the person who's doing the learning is a musical sponge.
Right.
Really.
David Pinkham?
My question goes not so much for fiddling, but it goes to Colleen.
Yeah.
And only because my family and her family does at least one song that there are two versions to that I know of. And I'm no scholar, but I've always been intrigued with the entomology of a song and the story that goes behind it. And Colleen, what do you think is the reason for the version difference between the Lumberman's Alphabet? Your tune is totally different than the one our family does.
Yeah.
And I look forward to hearing the two versions tonight.
Side to side again. It may just be somebody remembered the words or forgot the tune and put their own tune to it. It may be an chronological thing, mm-hmm. because a lot of the older tunes, if they were in a minor or a modal tune key or whatever, somebody with a guitar or somebody who couldn't play that key on the piano put it into another key that was easier for them to accompany. A lot of the unaccompanied ballads, I mean, I grew up, I don't know what key I sing in. I sing it where I can start it in the right spot to hit the high and the low spot.
Yes.
What key that is, I don't know. It could be R flat. But when you start accompanying it with a piano or with a guitar or with a chordal instrument, somebody's going to drop out that odd mm-hmm. note and substitute a different note. So I think that may be some of where that comes from. Some of it is just variance and who you learned it from.
Yeah,
and
Graham never had any accompaniment until I played a guitar with her.
Yeah, yeah.
So I
think that could be it.
Lynn, we're going to.
No,
that's it.
Okay.
I was always intrigued with the fact that I just wondered if your grandmother had ever explained her version, where it came from or anything.
She learned it from her Uncle Bobby. Mm-hmm. Bobby Wiggins was her mother's brother, and he worked in the logging camps up in Saranac. Yeah. And that's where he came from with that song, and that's who she learned it from. And a lot of her singing style is more the Scots and Northern Irish. There's less ornamentation in the ballads and stuff as compared to the Sean Noss, mm-hmm. very ornate, a lot of trills and a lot of jumps and things from the Southern Irish.
Yeah.
Well, I like the minor keys. I like those, but there's not the kind of sound that you get from the Gaelic style singing.
The mouth music.
It's a little more straightforward sounding. They don't stretch the words as much in the northern type of ballad singing.
Well, going back to something that Don Woodcock said, I'm the last in my generation that is a singer.
Mm.
I never could play as well as my mom could. And she tried to teach me. And because I couldn't do it, as well as she could right from the get-go, I wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. And no one in my generation does any of this music. Mm-hmm. And it is, I am in total agreement with Don Woodcock. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want his father's music to fall away.
I am so
thankful that you folks are doing what you're doing, because there is a heritage here that has, as all of you different ones have said, there have been generations drop out. All you need is one person in a generation to drop away, mm-hmm. and all of their knowledge is gone.
Yeah.
And it's perfect for what you guys are doing. And boy, from the bottom of my heart, I thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, actually, David, thank you, because this is a terrific segue to talk about collecting. To talk about collecting and the whole role of collecting and how it's been going on for generations now, actually. Who started to do it? Under what circumstances did they start to do it? Bob, obviously you took on the job of collecting. Some other people at the table have also done that. Why is it important to you? Is it personally, and even from the point of the discipline of folk study, why is it so important to collect these things?
I think what I'd really like to do, Eric, if it's all right, is to answer that with a little something I prepared, because it fits, and it fits the segue that we just did. And I'm going to show a couple of images up here at the same time, and maybe have a surprise or two towards the end, but we'll see about that. In my home office in Florida, I cherish a framed small photograph of my Midwest grandfather, my mother's father, playing the accordion. He died in 1969. There's no date for the image, but I recognize the background as what he called his small music room at his home in Chicago. That would put it before the mid-1950s. I have no idea what song or instrumental tune he was playing or just why he looked so self-satisfied doing so. What a legacy tribute it would be to have available an audio recording of the performance available online and accessible now for my four grandsons, three of whom play the piano. Fortunately, the achievement of Tawny's W is for the Woods website owes much to recorded sound technology, and its use is to document and capture traditional Adirondack music makers and music making in substance and sound. Can you switch the... In the collector's section of the website, you'll find reference to dictaphone cylinder recordings in the 1930s. Mechanical disc recordings during the 1940s. Can we have the next one?
There you go. She got it.
There we go. Anyway, this is Marjorie Lansing Porter. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, whatever. And she's using by the 1950s reel-to-reel magnetic tape recordings. Audio cassette tape recordings complemented reel-to-reel recordings during the 1970s and 80s. Standard technology today, of course, and since about 1990, is digital audio recording. Contributing to the project reminded me time and again of the marvel and the value of this evolving technology to record human voices and instrumental music, as well as to connect folks in folk tradition, indeed family heritage across generations. All of this was especially brought home to me in a pointed and totally unexpected way in July of 2007. I'd like to share the happenstance of that at this gathering. It's an account, ultimately, of what strikes me as grandfathering tradition. The summer of 2007, email from Mark Monica, Central Square, New York, arrived among a cluster of conversation emails then going on back and forth with Dave Ruck during early evolution of the website. And this is the email. Dear Dr. Bethke, hopefully this email finds its way to you, as I'm looking for materials related to my grandfather, Wilford Monica, who you interviewed for your book, Adirondack Voices. Just hold it there. During my college days at SUNY Canton, or next one, please. During my college days at SUNY Canton, I had the pleasure of attending Verik Chittenden's classes. As you may know, he has long been a folklorist and a local folklorist in St. Lawrence County, and his family was also very close to my grandfather. Upon completing his class in 1989, Professor Chittenden did me a wonderful favor and gave me a copy of a record that you had also recorded with Ted Ashlaw. That's the cover of it. Ever since then, I've been wondering to myself if there were any remaining recordings of my grandfather. Continuing, I'm not sure if you would still have research materials from the book, such as notes, tape recordings, or such, but I'd love to be able to share these items with my children, Wilfred's great-grandchildren. Warm memories of a childhood day spent at the Silas Wright House when you had, had a signing that come to me every time I passed that building. This would have been May of 1981 here down the street. I couldn't have been much more than 7 or 8, but I remember you signing my father's copy. It was a great day for my entire family. Sadly, my father passed away a month ago, and he would have loved to have known that I'm pursuing this. If there's any hope, some way to hear the recordings of my grandfather, I would be so grateful. Thanks, Mark Monica. Receipt of this email brought back a flood of memories. A photograph I took of Wilfred Monica does appear in the book along with references to him here and there, but I needed to tell Mark that there were no audio recordings done by me with his grandfather. Thus, no recorded evidence of his reputation as an accomplished woodsman singer. I needed to also to tell Mark about this disappointment, because Wilfred Monica surely belonged in the company of brothers Theodore Ashlaw and Edward Ashlaw as a separate chapter in Adirondack Voices. Keep going. Theodore Ashlaw in this image next, and then Edward Ashlaw's brother. Wilfred Monica requested that I not tape record what turned out to be our one-time interview at his home in August 1974. He also declined to sing. These decisions were for personal reasons that Wilfred said he had discussed with his wife, Rose. Eddie Ashlaw, with whom Wilfred had shared songs and singing occasions since youth, had told me that Wilfred was like many loggers who used to drink pretty regularly and who sang while intoxicated. But, said Eddie, Wilfred at one point gave it up, and I don't know as he'll want to sing too much if he ain't been drinking. In my return email to Mark Monica, I shared all of these details along with my handwritten commentary for the interview with his grandfather as found in my fieldwork notebook diary. Here's a portion of that commentary, for present purposes limited to excerpts that focus on traditional Adirondack music and music making. And so this is from my diary. Arrived at Wilfred Monica's home on Ridge Street in Norwood at 7:30 p.m. This is 1974. He's a short man who reminds me a little of a fuller-faced Bing Crosby. Weathered skin, sparkling eyes, a gift for talking at length. He preferred not to have recorders, so we sat in the kitchen at a table, and he looked while I took occasional notes. He talked while I took occasional notes. His wife sat watching TV and knitting in an adjacent room the entire evening. The interview lasted until 11:15. Even then, Wilfred said he could go on talking all evening, and I believed it. A remarkable man at age 76. Wilfred was raised about a mile and a half from the Ashlaws on Lake Azonia Road. His father was French-Canadian, who, according to Ted Ashlaw, was a marvelous singer of folk songs from that heritage. He began working in the woods at age 17, his first job at a cuttings operation back of Lake Azonia. He continued woods work until about 1954 or so. Thereafter, he worked at a Norfolk paper mill several years for the town and continues to cut cedar posts and cedar for cedar oil production. He's working by himself at present. In the woods, he was a teamster, primarily a hook man with pride in his can't-hook ability. He skidded, loaded, and hauled logs himself, much hardwood, little pulp. Like the Ashlaw brothers, he grew up with Johnny P. Lowe. Like Ted, learned songs from him. Wilford clearly was a singer. He was quite willing to talk about his repertoire, even though he did not want to attempt a song. He recited the lyrics of several songs, and no doubt would have recited the lyrics of all of them if requested, but without using recording equipment, I saw little sense in it. Early in the interview, Wilford recalled that Howard Haynes used to say, "I had a song for every purpose." Among those were "Willie Was His Finest Sailor," a favorite of his, "Fatal Wedding Night," "The Blue and the Gray," "Jim Green," "Old Mickey Brannigan's Pup," "The Tie That Binds," "Where the River Shannon Flows," "Message from Over the Sea," "Beyond the Level with Mother," "Tramp at the Bar," "Alan Bain," "Banks of the Little Old Plain," "Mother, Queen of My Heart," "The Jam on Gary's Rock," and "The Wild Mustard River." Just a parenthesis here, that in a nutshell is a profile of Adirondack traditional music in its variety. So you can see why everything had such great promise about this man. Like other wood singers, Wilford looked on the old long songs as being essentially true, or at least believable or plausible. The old songs in his view were generally about events that really happened or seemed like they really nearly could have happened. He was on one occasion a song maker. He made up a song on a Deary Down tune about experiences connected with Kinsey Goodrow, a lumbering job near Santa Clara at Lake Massawippi? Massawippi? Okay, Massawippi, thanks. About men drinking before going up on a train into the woods. 10 Polish workers sent out for liquor. The liquor is subsequently taken by other jacks. Irritation ensues, and after a day at camp and some needling, the 10 Polacks quit. The song was about the whole affair from outset to conclusion. It was written out in longhand on paper and sung immediately. Wilford said, "A good, strong voice was perhaps the most important prerequisite for a singer and a knowledge of songs." I asked him about Theodore Ashlaw's reputation as a singer. If he'd been singled out, Wilford replied, "Ted was a good singer, not unusual in his talents. He was about like some of the rest of us." He was about like some of the rest of us. What a wonderful remark. At that, a classic Adirondack woodsman singer's remark. In a subsequent email to me, Mark Monica wrote that he had been learning more about his grandfather from Wilford, from family members following Wilford's decease in 1982. Quoting Mark, "A man greatly loved. He led far from the perfect life, one he was proud and not so proud of, but very much the typical life of a man of his time and especially a man of the woods. Disappointed as I remain about no tape-recorded evidence for Wilford Monica, Adirondack woodsman and traditional singer, this project has provided me with numerous opportunities both to contribute to and reflect upon what I call here grandfathering tradition. And in the case of Mark Monica, great-grandfathering tradition at that. I recorded the, and I'm nearing the end here, I recorded the following recollection from Ted Ashlaw. It's found in the book, and if this forum or portions of it make their own way recorded to Tawny's W's for the Woods website, which I hope, I would like to believe that Wilford Monica might smile at how everything has turned out. This is from Ted Ashlaw. "There was an old fellow that lived next to my father up on the Lake Azonia Road, old man Monica. And oh, he was a good singer, but it was all in French. And at that time, I'd grown up and I didn't understand half of it, but I could sit and listen to that man sing all night, all day. Boy, oh boy, what a voice, and couldn't he sing? And I'll never forget, one night he was over to my folks, and my father asked him to sing some old song, and they used to sing together or something, and he couldn't think of it, couldn't get it together. Anyway, that night, after they drank what they wanted and they went to bed, that old man sang that song after he went to sleep. And he sang every bit of it right in his sleep. He must have been thinking of it when he lay down. I don't know what the song should have sounded like in English, but it certainly was something. So back to me. So yes, Mark, I suppose after all I'm able to pass along some grandfathering tradition things and for you to share with your children, Wilfred's great-grandchildren. And by the way, you emailed me that you and other family members have stories and tidbits of lore about your grandfather. And such would make a wonderful contribution to the Tawny Archives, indeed, I say, particularly if audio recorded. And I'd like to introduce Mark Monica. And I'd like to reintroduce you to Professor Chittenden.
I thought that was you, Mark.
I had Professor Chittenden. This is Mark Monica. I had Professor Chittenden for a year at SUNY Canton with a folklore class, and I believe when I tried to get in touch with Bob Bethke, I mentioned it was one of my favorite classes in college. So.
Thanks. Do you want to, since we have you, Mark? Do you want to add anything? Have I told any lies about your grandfather?
No. I think that was part of the lumbering, the jacking tradition was a lot of stories. There was a lot of truth and a lot of lies, like I think you mentioned. Part of it was the stories being passed down, and whether you believe them or not, it's the same with, I believe Colleen mentioned, with some of the stories, how they changed. Each region tried to change those stories to suit their lives and what happened there. So it's great to hear all this and to hear what my grandfather went through as a young man and passed down to my father. And on the way up here, my mother spoke nicely of my grandfather speaking in French, and I could never even imagine him speaking French, but he spoke in French quite a bit, I guess, when she first met him. And it was kind of interesting to hear about my great-grandfather speaking in French all the time around the camps. And I believe my great-grandmother was up there often singing also, working the camps. But,
You wrote to me that you're that Wilfred really wasn't that accustomed to being photographed. I was fortunate, you can see, of getting a photograph.
Yes, my father got the same trait from him also. He didn't like photographs very much. In the background are cabinets that he created in his shop. In his garage, he made those for my grandmother. I believe one of my aunts, I think my aunt still has those. Was a very talented man. He worked with cedar after he got out of the woods, worked for years at Alcoa here locally. Had a lot of talents, and I try to learn as much about him as I can to pass on to my children. So
great. I have to do a little aside here, too. I'm in my own growing up over east of here, about 25 miles, in the hamlet of Hopkinton, which is actually about 7 miles from Lake Azonia, and the town at which you usually go to get to Lake Azonia. My family had a general store, and as a kid, I was always fascinated by the lumbermen who would come in. I remember one man... He was a giant. He was probably 6'2" and very stocky and all, but his name was Harry Puryear. He had the big black beard, sort of heavy, thick black hair, big black beard, and burly, you know, the plaid jacket, the whole thing, the wool, probably the Malone woolen pants and all. And he was, I remember he would come in a dump truck. Because I was, in a log truck, he would pull up in front at the store, and this was back in the days, you know, when there were still bulk goods, and he would buy 25 pounds or 50 pounds of flour, and he would buy all big quantities of stuff for his family. This was not for the lumber woods, and there were the Ashlaws and the Parkers and the Monicas and all of those folks that I grew up with, not knowing that they were French. I knew that they were woodsmen, you know, and I just wish I'd known that they were storytellers and singers all those days, too, but it really brings all that stuff back to me, too. So we're delighted you're here, Mark, and that you had a great, terrific presentation on that, too, Bob. Any other comments? I know that time is going on here. Any comments more about collecting, the role of collecting? Dave, you certainly have been collecting and collecting collectors.
Well, yeah, I've been more compiling than collecting. Well, I guess one of the things that has always frustrated me about we're fortunate that so much of this music has been collected, has been documented, has been recorded. In the case of the Adirondacks, since I guess the late 30s, in terms of audio recording, but it's all been scattered all over the place. I think I mentioned this on the radio interview the other day. And very little of it is accessible. We know that Marjorie Lansing Porter recorded several Adirondack singers and fiddlers in the 40s, 50s, 60s, but most people have never heard that stuff. We know that Helen Hartness Flanders, who mainly collected in New England, came across and got some northeastern Adirondack singers in the 1930s and early 40s. Most people have never heard that stuff. The Warners, Anne and Frank Warner, who collected from Yankee John Galusha of Minerva, which is right in the central Adirondacks, starting in 1939, he was a man who was already 80 years old, so he was born in 1859. They recorded him singing, I think, about 5 dozen songs. Most people have never heard that stuff. So a few of the songs have now come out on a CD. But so one of my frustrations, I guess, as someone who's interested in this stuff, is it's so damn hard to get at. And so that's one of the things I love about this website is it has aggregated so many of these different recordings, and not just from the 30s and 40s, but all the way up to some recordings I made of Hermina 2 years ago. So it's wonderful to have it all in one place. And it's wonderful that we've had all these people collecting over the years, from those early pioneering collectors up here through to Bob Bethke, without whose research and recordings the website would not be 50% as rich as it is. And so that's my take on collecting up here. Thank God it happened, and as inaccessible as it is, as most of it is, we've been able to pull a lot of it out. So
our tawny friend Martha Cooper, the photographer whose portraits have been taken downstairs on the Wall of Fame, has done a lot of work for Tawny, and things come and go. It's impossible to preserve everything, and as time goes on, changes occur. And I think as folklorists, we recognize that there are new traditions forming and old traditions that go. And as much as you'd like to keep everything, you can't keep everything. And I think the comment that Marty Cooper makes, it's somewhat jokingly, but also is that if something disappears, whatever it is, she'll often say, well, at least we got the photographs, you know. And so, you know, I think the idea of making a record and keeping a record, and I will say as a little bit of a plug for Tawny in the future, in our future planning for this building, we are really seriously planning to develop a significant archive space, under the correct kinds of conditions, and not only on the conditions, but also ultimately to sort through all of this wonderful material that has either come to us or that we know about from other places, and put it in one place as kind of a central repository, but also something that could be easily accessed. That's a huge job to go through and create a finding aid that can really make it accessible. But our plan is to have the controlled circumstances, the climate control and all in which to do that, and also to have in the back area over here a small room that'll be a combination, if you're familiar with StoryCorps, the organization that's traveled around, we're expecting to have a small, it'll be a combination either a listening booth and a recording booth, so that if somebody has a favorite uncle whose story needs to be recorded, they could actually bring them in here in the future, and either one of us might do it, or we could train somebody else how to do the actual recording of the story. So it's a combination of being able to go through the stuff with music and all. It may be a little more ambitious, and we have good friends up the road at North Country Public Radio, have great studio conditions, and we expect that with that kind of thing can be done too. So it's part of our plan to do that. Any further comments about collecting? And
Phyllis was telling me that Ken Bonner visited your house, and you spent some time with your mom playing the piano and Ken playing the fiddle with a little cheap, probably like mine, portable cassette recorder running. Mm-hmm. Right? Every time I went to a dance at home, I have a dozen or more boxes of my wife had stashed in a barn. I don't even know, and there's probably 300 or 400 of these cassette tapes
from just going to a dance and letting the thing run and turn it over and let it run.
Sure.
This is obviously not well organized. When I take a long trip sometimes, well, I'll take like two of those tapes and I'll sit there with one hand logging. I got one right here. Right. Ken Bonner doing a tune that sounds like Polly Put the Kettle On. Ken Bonner doing Duck for the Oyster. Ken Bonner doing, right, on that one cassette tape. He's one of the special guys that we could use a lot more recordings. But how many more little cassette recordings are there popping around in people's
exactly
homes? Yeah. Any at home or whatever?
I had the same thing.
Yeah. These are all over the state, not just
right.
here in Catskills
right.
as much and
all over the country.
Forth. Yes, all over
that's
the
right.
country.
Yeah.
Two of the things we used on the website came from a guy in Tennessee who had one recording in particular. He had a Northern New York Mohawk Indian fiddler named Phil Cook, who was from Akwesasne, and had learned his tunes from his father, who was a square dance fiddler, and he thought their fiddling went all the way back to the 1500s when the Jesuit missionaries came through. Now, that's the story that was handed down to him. Whether that's actually true or not is irrelevant. This guy, Phil Cook, had moved out to the Northwest, to Washington State, and was recorded out there in the 1970s when he was about 70 years old, playing Northern New York square dance tunes. I found out about it networking on the internet, and the only guy who had a recording of it was this guy in Tennessee. So here's this little piece of our heritage sitting in Tennessee somewhere. Now we've brought that back, which is great.
Yeah. Len, you had a comment?
When I was working on folk songs of upstate New York about 20 years ago, I was doing some collecting in Cortland County because the intent of the book was to be used strictly with Cincinnatus students. Cincinnatus is a little hamlet of, you know, we've got maybe 750 students, K through 12, and never expected it to go beyond that. And now it's being sold on the internet. But the first section of the book, I did it mostly by county or by region, But the first section is probably larger than all the rest because it's Cortland County, and these were Cortland County kids that I was working with. But I had the opportunity to sit with a fellow named Art Weiser, who played fiddle, and I think he was active in the Corning area back in the 30s and 40s and so on. Got him playing Red Wing and Golden Slippers. And another fellow who named Lyle Peake, who was just a farmer, but he liked to play guitar with various country bands, and he sang a wonderful square dance version of I can't think of the name of the tune now.
Irish Washerwoman?
No.
Can you sing it?
Hum it. Yeah, I was just going to say hum it. Somebody
else. Da 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 da. And it's back with the left hand, so they say. Yes, Nellie Gray. Thank you, darling Nellie Gray. But it was just it was, and those are tunes which I probably, except for, with the possible exception of Golden Slippers, wouldn't have thought of as, you know, New York State tunes. These guys who, you know, they just played, that was just part of their repertoire, mm-hmm. some of the stuff that they knew. Mm-hmm. And so it was a good experience.
Great. That sort of thing. Well, I think we could probably, the people at the table could just tell stories about collecting all afternoon, and I would love to be able to do that. But I am a little conscious of the time, and I would like to move on. I have a question for Colleen, and then I'd like to go to talk about passing the music along. Colleen, how do you know how your grandmother felt about being collected or being documented? Did she ever talk about that? Because she was one of the early ones to be documented.
Probably, yeah. Much like me, I think she thought people overthunk it too much. why do you sing it this way? Why do you sing it that way? Why do you sing this word and not that word? It's because that's how you learned it. And much like me, it was, I didn't realize other families did not do this, that I didn't realize other families didn't sing all the time, or that other families didn't have this. It wasn't until, I think, Vaughn Ward sat me down after my grandmother had passed away and said, look, you know, you're the only one who's got this and has, you know, these songs with this heritage, with this lineage, you know, and you sort of really should think about doing something with it. And at that time, I hadn't really thought that much about it. So that's my answer to...
So how did she feel about, you know, going on the festival circuit and all of that, which was...
I think she really enjoyed it. I especially think she enjoyed meeting other people who had versions of songs and things. I think it took it back to growing up and that kind of almost a familial atmosphere where people were happy to open their mouth and sing, and they didn't think you were unusual if you did that. I know it's like that for me. You get around singers, and it makes you even more comfortable, or musicians, to open your mouth and sing and play these kind of things, where nowadays it's not quite such a common thing, or people look at you funny if you're walking down the street singing a song, you know.
Especially an incest ballad.
Well, yeah, that's what, yeah. Or rumshianity, where the
they don't get it.
Yeah. or something like rumshianity, where the chorus is particularly noxious. But, so.
Interesting. Good. George?
I think a lot comes down to the fact that this stuff is community music. Mm-hmm. And the community in days of yore was family, was crossroads, was neighborhood. And I think of a lot of the people who are people who find their way into the folk music revival or who are kids who grew up in it, who find they can really only share this with other people who had the same experience. It's not something you can go to high school and talk to your friends about because they don't get it. But the people who do get it, really, the music still makes a home. That's my money quote for the day. Really, it still does that. And the stories. How much of this can you have without the stories about the people, for better or worse? But it does. It makes community. That's I think that's a lot of why we treasure.
Good. Okay, I'd like, as far as my last question for the group, and I'm thinking particularly, I guess everybody, maybe but you and me, Bob, are performing artists, and particularly perform for kids, and in a teaching situation or simply in an entertainment situation. But where does this all fit in? I mean, we're talking about some of this music that's ancient, you know, and some of it that isn't sung around the kitchen table or at home anymore. How can we bridge that gap? How do you bridge the gap, if you will, if it's in fact a gap, by teaching, working with young people, not necessarily very young, but young people? Who wants to jump in on the role of this for the future? Jim,
go ahead.
Well, I'm at a college, of course, and I do some programs occasionally for kids in museums and so on, but at the college, SUNY Geneseo, which is a state college, and I really like being at a state college. We get a lot of New York kids. That's where most of them are from. And occasionally we'll get somebody who is. We had Carol Hudson showed up. Well, she was off a dairy farm in Wales, New York. Her family gone square dancing before she came to the college, and there's still old-fashioned rural grange dances happening in Western New York. Well, I got a string band. I started the string band in 1976. We've been doing dances since just about then, and at some early point, there was another faculty member that was teaching Western Square Dance Club stuff on campus as phys ed class. Well, I started doing what I'd done in Poland, go out around the country. Well, what are they dancing out here? Darling Nellie Gray, Marching Through Georgia, Birdie in the Cage, so forth, and said, well, we're going to play those tunes and do those dances. So we start getting the whole dairy farm sets coming on campus to join our college dances, but the other half are the college students who don't know one thing from another thing, and you got to work it very carefully. But we've been doing them ever since. And there's a lot of college kids who didn't grow up on dairy farms who are enjoying these. Will any of them take them further? Well, Carol Hudson has. She's calling her own square dances now a little bit there in Western New York. We've had a couple students. We've had half a dozen spin-off string bands as people have moved elsewhere, including Sue Grimm back there, who was in the band years ago, and she was a library grad student at Geneseo. And we get requested to do dances, so the student will move on. Interestingly, a bunch of these are church-related things. In somebody's barn out in Honeyway Falls, we do a couple of those every year. We're playing in a barn dance for a bunch of young and old, sponsored by a church that thinks square dancing is a great thing to do. And we're still doing Darling Nellie Gray.
They were Baptists.
I decided from the get-go we were not going to do the contra dance scene. We weren't going to do Western square dance. They don't like live musicians anyway. We would do what was there. So this is at least one thing that I've been trying to do for a long time, and these dances are still happening.
Yeah, catch on.
We still get people. They're every bit as much fun as any of the others.
I've been working in education for 27-some years now, and one of the biggest difficulties in promoting one's own tradition within the community is that it has to balance with everything else that the kids are exposed to. I mean, popular music these days is just such a powerful influence on kids, whether good or bad, and it's a difficult thing to contend with. In my own work, I try to do as much work with teaching music reading skills as I can, using an adapted Kodai method and using solfege and the hand signs and the whole thing. But then that has to be balanced with other aspects. I use a great deal of folk music with that Kodai approach. That has to be balanced with something that is a little more to their interest. Constantly having to be careful to be sure to listen to things ahead of time so that they're not offensive to anybody's parents. But then fitting in the folk songs as well. Particularly with, when I get them as fifth graders, they have been through fourth grade, which is their year for studying New York State history, but they're still facing the state test in November. So there's time for a little review there prior to that. So I pull out the folk songs of upstate New York and teach them to the kids. We'll do it for three or four weeks, something like that, as an adjunct to everything else that we're doing. And they really love the Barefoot Boy. And some of them with a darker personality really like Frozen Charlotte. again, the challenge is to balance that. Yes, they need to be exposed to that stuff. They need to sing those old songs and to understand a little bit about how those songs came into being and the circumstances under which they were sung, under which they were created. That's all very important. But it's got to balance with everything else that they're doing. You know, that's why it's wonderful that we have people like Dave Ruck who can come into a school and provide some of those things to the kids that they won't necessarily get from their regular music teacher.
Thanks, Lynn.
Sure.
George? Or?
Yeah. I'm trying to think where and how to start and how to make it short. I was a classroom teacher at various levels. Loved middle school when I was young enough to have the energy to love middle school. I don't know if I could do it now. And then in 1976, left that to become an artist or folklorist, and those were sort of two different hats in education going into people's schools. What I liked least, and that is still true, is simply going in to do an assembly. I have to think back and remember being exposed to assemblies that were probably life-changing for me, because it sure doesn't feel that way when you go in and do it. What I liked to do, and it's harder and harder with the pressures on teacher, were projects of one sort or another. When I think about this, I have pictures going through my mind of a classroom of kids holding up model tugboats that we built because we were, I was doing songs of the Erie Canal, but what, I wanted to give them some sort of sense of ownership of that so they had some reason to want to sing the songs. I can show you how to make model Erie Canal boats out of almost anything. When we toured with the Irish band, it was the same thing. We would have, I burned out my bandmates, but we would have hundreds of kids building instruments that worked on the principles on which ours worked. Hopefully ours sounded better. It's a matter of ownership of kids having some sort of stake in their own learning. As a folklorist, this was a matter of having kids go out into the community and learn about their families, and they were the experts, they were the people who were responsible for presenting these family stories and carrying them on. Maybe a matter of setting kids up to do what Mark figured out he wanted to do automatically on his own. How does it all turn out? I will tell you, I don't believe in testing as a way of proving a thing that's worth proving. The kid who comes up to me in Stewart's, the hulking truck driver in his 40s, who says, "Mr. Ward, I remember when we..." That's my test. Mm-hmm. That's my test. The kid who goes on and calls dances or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they exist and they will. And they will haunt you in the best way possible.
What about your own two sons, George? Have they... I mean, they've obviously grown up hearing you do all this stuff. Have they taken up an interest in some of the same music?
Same thing. They grew up in this folk song community with other kids who did, and they tend to be still in touch with one another now with all the social networking sites. How can you not? But because it's something that they can share with other kids that they grew up with who had this, that doesn't make a tremendous amount of sense to people in other contexts. Modern kids who were exposed to a lot of different social contexts get really good at this. So, yeah, my son Nathaniel will sit down and play fiddle tunes with you on his mandolin all night because at the age of 30 he realized, oh, my God, the mandolin is a lot easier to play than the guitar. This is a man who worked as a jazz guitarist in his 20s. But the music, when he had a daughter that became important to him, mm-hmm. all of a sudden was the stuff he'd grown up with. And his brother, who has always sort of wanted to be a rock star and is, but in a different line of work, nevertheless keeps the guitar handy. Yeah, it's a Les Paul, but what the heck? I mean, he can do the same stuff. They grew up with it. They couldn't get away from it. They don't want to. And the different form, how will it all turn out? I don't know. I don't know what my granddaughter's going to do with it. She's immersed in it. That's the thing that's exciting to me. How does it turn out? When is the guy going to say over his coffee at Stewart's, "I remember when"?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Jill.
I keep thinking I'm tempted, and I hope you won't mind. I'd like to put Sue Grimm on the spot, actually, yeah. in this discussion. Because Sue is somebody that I've known for a long time in the North Country, and I think a lot of what we're talking about she could address and maybe bring it back around to the rest of you to talk about perpetuation. But Sue is somebody who lives in the region, is really interested in this music, plays this music, seeks it out, makes a real effort to find it. And I'm just wondering, Sue, since you're here in the room with us today, if you could comment on sort of your reaction to the things people are saying and sort of how you see yourself fitting in all of this in terms of learning the music, passing it on, enjoying it, that sort of thing.
I can think of two things that I'd love to say, the first of which is I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if it wasn't for Jim Kimball, so he's very successful at what he does. I think it was probably the fall of 1981 when I was a grad student at SUNY Geneseo after having a classical four-year music degree from Crane and having to just not play for a year because it just wasn't what I needed music to be. But there I was and my flute and piccolo in hand, and I went to the music building and I looked at the bulletin board thinking, well, maybe there's something about music that I can love. and I saw a poster saying, come tonight for the tryouts for the string band. The what? I had no clue what a string band was. A chamber orchestra. Oh, that's nice. And suddenly around the corner, a man with bright red hair and a bright red beard and a tweed coat and twinkling eyes poked his head around and saw that I was carrying instrument cases. He said, are you coming tonight? I said, well, I play the flute. Well, the piccolo would be very good on some of our pieces. I'll bet you play some piano, don't you? And you should come tonight. So Jim reaches out and passes on and closes that gap admirably, and it's changed my life. Right now I'm teaching kinder music to little kids, trying to teach them traditional songs, nursery rhymes, folk songs. We dance around the room to fiddle tunes. They have not heard these. Their parents have not heard them. One of the kids is brought in by her grandmother, who barely remembers some of them. There's a huge gap, and we've got to jump in and fill it. And I'm proud to be somebody who is doing that because someone did that for me. I'm also very proud of my mom here, who taught public school music for, she probably doesn't want me to say how many years. But in her public school music class, there was dancing, there was square dancing, there was folk music, there was classical music, there was every kind of music, there was a little bit of everything. And kids who couldn't read music and could barely read were singing the Messiah in parts at their high school concerts in Star Lake, New York. So it's a mission, it's a passion, yeah. It's important. And congratulations on the new website. I just think it's phenomenal.
Thank you.
Any other comments from the group? I'm going to have Dave finish up here in a minute, but... Anybody else have a question or a story that was inspired by things being said today? A good fun story that Jill was seeking out from all of you. Well, Dave, why don't you wrap it up for us?
With?
Whatever you'd like to say.
Oh, all right. Well, who's coming tonight?
All right.
That's what I wanted to say. Great. Well, this is just, I have so much more to say, but nothing that I would keep anyone from their lunch for. Hopefully we'll have a chance to chat after this. Is there a little informal time
There's
after
informal
this?
Informal time. Some sandwiches coming in a little bit for Good. Anybody who wants to
I
join
see a
in.
Few instruments here, too. And there are more out in the car. But no, this has been a wonderful day or so far, and look forward to tonight, and I feel very honored to have been able to work with all of this great material and with all these great people for the last couple of years putting this website together.
You're not going to stop.
No. Just ask Varick. He can tell you that I don't stop.
So is this intended as an ongoing thing, that things will be added to it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's set up that way so that things can be added. There are already musicians that we weren't able to include the first time that we know we want to have on there. And hopefully more recordings will come to light. I'd love to talk to the Perkins family some more about their family music. And Don Perkins was saying he learned his music from his mother humming out the tunes as she played piano, and she'd hum out the melodies to the fiddle tunes, and that's how he learned. I suspect there's some great family music that goes back to your French Canadian parents and square dance music that was in your family for a while, and I'd love. So there's, I think it's an endless topic, and I hope to keep pursuing it for some time.
Our website is set up not only we know that we will be adding things. In fact, we'll be adding a recording of this today and the recording of the concert tonight to the website. But also it's set up in a way that you can contact us in the contact or the feedback form. Just send, if you know of an artist, if you know of something that you really think we should think about or some comment you'd like to make, we're going to try to add to that all as time goes on. So, yes, please keep all that stuff coming to us. Just a couple things. You mentioned the Perkins family. I do have to tell you a little story. I was just mentioning it to them before, and about the way I'm sure their lives have been. When they were being recognized for the Heritage Award before, whatever it was, 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Marty Cooper, who's our photographer, I mentioned her earlier. She and I usually go out on these road trips to do photo shoots, and so it was all set up to meet at Phyllis's home, and Don had come, and their mother was with them, and while the shoot was going on, Marty was taking different combinations of pictures, and Phyllis and Don were over by the piano, and they were playing and trying to look like they were playing for the photo and all, but Mrs. Perkins and I were sitting in the living room right adjacent. It was actually open room. There was a sofa there, and she and I were sitting together and just chatting and trying to watch all of this going on. So, and they were playing. So all of a sudden, Mrs. Perkins got up. Now she had a walker. So she got up, and I thought, well, maybe she was going to tell somebody something or whatever. She stood up, and they were playing a good lively jig or whatever it was they were playing, and all of a sudden she started to step dance inside her walker. So, I have that picture vividly on a little collecting mission of my own, there. So, the final thing I would say is that Joel and I were talking at the little intermission earlier. You know, this is maybe just an ordinary day, but you know, in fact, we've recorded this event here, and she was saying 20 or 30 years from now, this is kind of a landmark event we've just been part of. Having all these people together who have spent their lives collecting this material and getting them all in one room and talking about it and sharing stories from both the musician's point of view and the scholar's point of view and the collector's point of view, it's a rare occasion, and we at Tawny are thrilled that you all came. Thank you for being here. Thank you, all of you, for coming in. Take some time to chat, if you will. There are some sandwiches coming in and just some light drinks and so forth. And do come to see us tonight at the concert. It should be fun. The Edwards Opera House is one cool place. So, okay. Thank you all very much.